This episode is sponsored by Hulu. The reality queen herself, Lisa Vanderpump, has a new home on Hulu and has teamed up with them to bring you the newest, most exciting reality series yet, Vanderpump Villa. In an escape to the French countryside, Lisa and her staff work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. The series offers first-class luxury with world-class drama. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. Welcome to So Bad It's Good with Ryan Bailey, presented by Betches Media. This is an exploration of all pop culture. From the classic reality TV moments of the past and present, to the latest Daily Mail headlines and everything in between. We'll dive into all the infamous and notorious messes you can't stop watching. We're looking at you, Tom Sandoval. Folks, welcome to an all-new episode of So Bad It's Good. This is your pal Ryan, and this is your Wednesday episode. You have made it halfway through the week. It is hump day. The hump day dance is a chance to do the hump. Yeah! Woo! That was way too much energy I just exerted right there. I think I pulled my sciatica. That's not an actual muscle. Anywho, how's everybody doing? I hope everybody's great. No, for real, you made it halfway through the week. You got two more days until that sweet, sweet weekend. So at this point, check out. It's okay. You've done your duty. Clock out. The next 2 days, just coast. You've done it. You put the hard work in. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that's all that matters. Thursday and Friday, blow it off completely. I hope everybody's doing good out there. Are you okay? If you're not okay, it's fine. You don't have to be. Just know that tomorrow will be better, you know? And if tomorrow's not better, the next day will be better. Just hang on. Man, everything is so crazy right now, isn't it? And I'm not just talking about tonight's episode of Vanderpump Rules, which was really, what a weird episode. And we'll talk about that on the recap on Thursday. I watched the Valley episode tonight as well. What a mess, man. My head is swimming in West Hollywood and Valley Village. That's the two sides of my brain are those sides. But today we do not have to talk about Vanderpump Rules or The Valley or reality shows at all. We have a great guest for you today. We have this gentleman, Marshall J. Kaplan is our guest today. And he is a multi-nominated television producer, a director, and just an all-around great guy. This was just a fabulous conversation, and I hope to talk to this man again because we just geeked out. We just geeked out. There are those certain people, like I love reality shows, obviously, but I love pop culture. I loved pop culture even before I knew that it was called pop culture. I don't know if you're like me. I think some of you guys are out there that I grew up in front of a television set. It's like one of the places where I felt most at home was in front of a TV or at the public library, or, you know, looking through CDs at Sam Goody or Tower Records. Like, that made me feel at home. Those were kind of my friends. I felt really safe watching all of that. I loved it. I loved comic books. I loved everything that had, like, a fandom around it. And, you know, I mean, reality shows are mainly what we talk about here, but we talk about so many other things. But Marshall, our guest today, you know, he first came to my attention because he produced a couple of things that I think are just amazing and really required viewing. He did CNN's The History of Sitcom, which I thought was just this amazing multi-part series. He's also done so many others, like just other, like his IMDb is just littered with amazing things. And of course, he has his own podcast now, but his podcast doesn't even have anything to do with his career. His podcast is called Prison Sentences, where he wrote pen pal letters with famous people in prison. Yeah. Like, you know, the Tiger King, Joe Exotic, Betty Broderick, Pamela Smart, Jared Fogle, Charles Manson. And these are really short episodes, where he would just write a very basic thing and he reads their response back. It's something that you can binge very easily. But I mean, it's fascinating that he does this, but he also does all of these other things that I've watched. You know, he gets some of the best interviews out of the people in these documentaries that I've seen. But also, you'll hear in this interview, we both just love pop culture. He started off as a kid as a caricaturist. Can you imagine that? I could barely draw a stick figure, and he was a caricaturist. And it's interesting how you get from point A to point B in life. You know, you never think you start as a caricaturist and you wind up a producer or a documentarian or a podcaster. Life throws all these twists and turns, but it's kind of all the same bubble. Entertainment and having a respect for entertainment, a respect for pop culture. And there is something in it that I've never truly been able to find the words for of why I love all of this so much. Why it made me feel so safe and protected when I would watch one of my favorite sitcoms as a kid. Why every room that I ever lived in, I had to put up movie posters. I had to have everything surrounding me that made me feel safe, whether it be action figures. I still do it. I collect merch. A lot of it's in my storage facility, unfortunately, but those things, it just brought me so much joy. And I think part of this show, why I started it to begin with, was I think we sometimes are made to feel shame for these things that we dearly love. And it was like, well, what if we don't feel shame? What if we run towards the thing that people sometimes make fun of us for? And what if the things that we love that we don't run away from, what if we can actually learn things from? What if we can actually have real conversations? We can laugh and poke fun, but what if we actually dive into it a little deeper and see if it truly does hold a mirror up to life? I remember growing up in Olathe, Kansas, and I remember just sitcoms. I remember sitcoms, you know, if you had a sick day from school, I remember you got to watch all the sitcoms, and it would be, you know, I Love Lucy, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and then it would go to like the 70s, like One Day at a Time, Good Times, and it was just these string of shows. And it gave you a language for comedy. It gave you a language for a setup and a punchline, you know, and these things. It was magic. And I would always fight to stay up as late as I could, you know, like, oh, can I stay up to watch Saturday Night Live? Oh, can I stay up to watch this? You know, each night of the week. And this is before we had cable. This is before we had cable. There was only what? You had like 5-6 stations to choose from. And each night had its thing, like Saturday Night Live, Saturday. Sunday was always a depressing night because I wasn't into sports. And I remember on Sunday night television, they had this show called, I think it was George Michael Sports Machine. And at first I was excited as a kid because I thought, wow, the musician George Michael has a sports show? I'll watch it just for that. And then you found out there was another guy called George Michael that did a sports show. And I remember that always making me really sad. Sundays always made me really sad. You had to go to school the next day and there was just nothing good on late night basic television. But it was these things. It was going to video stores and seeing if your favorite movie was on the shelf before there was streaming. It was going to the library and being able to check out CDs because I couldn't afford the CDs that I wanted before. You could just get anything for free on Spotify or Apple Music. And also the search for these things was part of the joy in it. Collecting, you know, finding that unique object at the right price and taking it home. And if it was an album, playing it from front to back. Now we just play songs, you know, the album sometimes is lost. But I would take every album or CD that my parents bought and I would listen. I was a kid listening to Kenny G and Michael Bolton, for the love of God, because it was the music my parents had. And I know I did. I knew I didn't love it, but it was something. You know what I'm saying? It was something. It had me connected somewhere. And when I was a kid growing up in Kansas, I always say this, but Los Angeles seemed like 80,000 miles away. It seemed like a place that didn't exist, that it was a fairy tale. It was an imaginary place where magic happened and that I never could be at. Oh, there's no way I could ever get to Hollywood. And that's why it really does blow me away that I did get here. And it's not always the fantasy that you dreamed that it was, but it is still magical in a lot of ways. I mean, there's so many hardships that go with living in a place like this, but there's still magic. There is still Sunset Boulevard that you'll drive down and you'll think about how many historic pictures or historic scenes from movies. You know, this was a place that you could tell a million stories in terms of pop culture. You know, right? I could go 4 or 5 miles away from where I am at right now and show you where in the 80s, Motley Crue shut down Sunset Boulevard. And then a block up where the Doors and Jim Morrison shut down the same street. You know, the Viper Room is right there that Johnny Depp once owned. River Phoenix unfortunately passed away in front of. And one of my favorites, Adam Duritz from Counting Crows, bartended in the downstairs bar at the Viper Room. But it was so wild to live in L.A. After I graduated from college. And then these places that were such magic to me as a kid, I started forming my own memories, my own stories, you know, you got to be a part of it. And I look back on all that stuff so fondly, and it is, you know, you don't realize it's magical at the time, but in retrospect, you realize, oh my God, it is magic. All of it is magic. So this conversation with Marshall meant a lot to me. Because I think it's just, at the end of the day, two geeks. He's a way more successful geek than I am, but two geeks nonetheless. And it's this thing that I still get excited about. You know, I look for the things that get me excited. I miss the days of magazines when you could get a hard copy of Entertainment Weekly or Premiere Movie Magazine. Do you guys remember Premiere? Oh my God. As a kid, I had a subscription. It was just this big old magazine, and it took you to another place with interviews with movie directors and talking about the new movies, or Entertainment Weekly when they did the fall movie preview or the winter movie preview or the summer movie preview. And it was a double issue. So you got like 130 pages and you would just flip through looking at all the movies, finding out what an art house film meant, you know, realizing what a blockbuster was, you know, trying to figure out what your taste was. What actually turned you on? What made you tick? What movie spoke to you? What TV show spoke to you? What music spoke to you? And I think that's just so personal, but at the same time, it's something I love to talk about. It's something I love to share, and I love when you guys share your loves with me. That's what it's all about, a communal society where we pass around things that we love. Like, oh my God, you watch this show, you're going to love it. Oh my God, have you heard this song? You're going to love it. Oh my God. This movie is going to make you cry. That's what pop culture means to me. It means everything. When I'm sad and depressed, I turn to music. I turn to comfort shows. When I'm happy, music, a TV show, or a movie can make me even happier. It's something that will never leave me, nor will I ever want it to leave me. And sometimes I get, you know, when I know I'm really down in the dumps is when I don't want to watch television or read a book or read an article. Like, I want constant information coming at me. I want to always be plugged in. And by plugged in, I don't mean surfing the internet, being online, social media, even though I am on all of those things a lot. But I think what it was as a kid, too, was that it was that I don't want to go to bed. I always want to be in touch with the world around me. And if you listen to the show, you know, sometimes in person, I get nervous. I don't sometimes know how to talk to talk in a normal situation with people around me. Or if I do, I'll go home at night and I'll like replay all those conversations and go, oh my God, I must have sounded like an idiot. But with pop culture, it was a way for me to feel connected to everything and everybody. And I never felt like I screwed it up. I felt like I was part of the process. I felt like enjoying something made me a part of the conversation. I mean, one of the bummers about streaming and television to me was I always felt like, oh, but it's still in my mind, this weird, tricky thing was that I always want to feel like something's live. Like I'm watching something where at any moment's notice, a news anchor would break in and be like, we have a breaking news story. You know, that's why I will never, you know, always have cable of some sort, because I always want to have some kind of news station where somebody can talk to me right now, day and date. I don't know why. Isn't that weird? Like, it's always like I want something to connect me to the right now, this moment, Right now, you're potentially listening to me on Wednesday, April, what is this? April 10th. Wednesday, April 10th. We're all in the same day, the same place, the same time, sharing these same experiences. And I think that's part of the why the eclipse was so fun and meaningful for so many people. Because like I said yesterday, it meant, man, we're all on this planet together, right? And pop culture can be those things, whether it like is an underground thing that you pass around and you whisper about and you feel really cool because you discovered it from before everybody else. Or it can be that blockbuster like Barbie, where like everybody has some opinion of it. Everybody has seen it. And that's exciting too. For me, pop culture has it all. So this conversation today with our guest, Marshall J. Kaplan, goes everywhere. But like I said, it's two geeks talking about our love of pop culture. And we get to talk about his fascinating career. I really do would love to talk to him again. And I do hope he comes to, when he comes to LA again, we do grab lunch like we talked about, because I think some of us, we just speak the same language. And I felt like I speak the same language with Marshall. So today we're going to get to the interview right now. This has nothing to do with reality television. And I got to tell you, it is so flipping refreshing. And it reminds me of my roots. And by roots, I mean a little kid growing up in Olathe, Kansas, watching every sitcom that I could get my eyes on without having cable television. So without further ado, our guest today is Marshall J. Kaplan. Come back on Thursday. Vanderpump Rules recap. Friday, we'll have a Valley recap. More episodes on the Patreon. I did an hour and a half Summer House recap over there. Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on YouTube. Everything. We're everywhere, folks. But I just hope you guys have the best Wednesday that you can possibly have. And we'll talk to you on Thursday. Bye. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So, the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Folks, welcome back to So Bad It's Good, presented by Betches Media. Today, this is a breath of fresh air for me. I am so locked into reality shows right now, and it is so great to break out of that and talk about general love of pop culture and what it means to me and other people. And also, I got this email a while back, and I thought it was a prank email because I was like, this person is just cold emailing me out of the blue, and it turns out they have this amazing list of credits. Our guest today, you know, he's the director and also writer on certain episodes of a series that I loved on CNN called History of the Sitcom. But this man has done it all. He, you know, he literally has just been nominated for the version of like the Canadian Emmys. He just got nominated for, I believe it's called The Dark Side of Comedy, that is on Vice. But his IMDb, his resume is littered with things that I have watched throughout my years, but there is this certain spotlight that is put on pop culture. I mean, he even did the history of game shows for ABC. But then when I started researching him a little bit, there were so many nuggets of information that I was like, oh, I just want to talk to him about this. I want to talk to him about this. So let's get into this. Because he has a new podcast out called Prison Sentences, which these are little bite-sized podcasts where he literally tries to become pen pals with people like John Gotti or people like Betty Broderick and see if they write back. But they're so bite-sized. It's like a nice little refreshing aperitif, if you will. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Marshall J. Kaplan. Marshall, thank you so much for being here.
Well, the pleasure's all yours. I just want to know, you're filming me, right? Like, I just want to make sure I'm on camera. I am filming of you.
If you
okay, I showered for this, Ryan. Perfect. I just
well,
want
I
you
didn't,
to know.
I didn't, Marshall, so that perfect. We started off good.
We balance each other. Go ahead.
Okay, let's start. So you just told me before we started, you just got nominated last week. Was it Canadian Emmy or what was it? You got nominated?
What we do here, we don't have the Oscars and the Emmys. What they do is they consolidated both our film and television into the Canadian Screen Awards. So I woke up and someone texted me and they said, congrats on your nomination. And I got nominated for Best Director in a Factual Series. And that was for The Dark Side of Comedy for Vice for the Joan Rivers episode, which was awesome. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Joan Rivers, and I was just, you know, we all watched the Oscars this past weekend, and Joan Rivers was so brilliant on the red carpet of these award shows and then the Fashion Police episodes, which even my parents, weirdly enough, don't really follow tons of pop culture, but they would watch Fashion Police. They
yes.
loved Joan Rivers. And I think it's so amazing that her legend continues to grow even in the afterlife. When you do a piece like that, when you're directing a piece like that, how do you approach a factual docuseries, if you will?
Well, basically, you know, you have your team of story producers and they'd all do the research of the episode, right? And then I go out in the field and the Joan Rivers episode was an episode I pitched to Vice, which got approved because I felt we should do an episode on her dark side, which was the plastic surgery. What happens is we do our research on it. I then choose who I feel should be interviewed for it. I got Pamela Adlon. I got George Schlatter, who discovered
wow.
her from Laugh-In. Right. And anyways, I go out there with the beats we want to cover, you know, make sure we get these nuggets to tell the story. But if anything else comes out of that interview, let it roll. Because sometimes whatever you get in addition to the story is better than the story. So I go in there kind of with my beats. And the way I do my interviews, which I love doing, is you sit with 2 hours with these people and just have a conversation.
Yeah.
And let well, versus asking question, get an answer. That's too boring.
That's the thing sometimes is that you want to be prepared enough so you can actually be loose enough to let whatever happens. In the course right. of doing the Joan Rivers episode in particular, were there any detours that were discovered in the interview process that was like, oh, that's amazing?
I didn't really know the history between George Schlatter and her. And I thought that because I was such a fan of Laugh-In. And
yeah.
when I kind of found out that George was involved, I gave his office a call, got the interview. And it was George Schlatter, which I found was really cool. What he did is the reason why he sort of brought her to the forefront and gave her first television break was because that's what he did with female comedians. They weren't on television. So he would get people like Ruth Buzzi and Joanne Worley and Judy Carn and Goldie Hawn. Because you didn't see female comedians. So he
yeah.
was a, what do you call it? He really was the forerunner in getting female comedians on television.
Which is truly amazing. But also Joan Rivers is fascinating because she had a series of men in her life like that. Johnny Carson was another one of those men, waved her over. She was then a guest host when Johnny to fill in for Johnny and their
yeah.
relationship infamously broke up when she did the Joan Rivers show for Fox. And Johnny never talked to her again for the rest of her life. But it is interesting, like the dark side of comedy. I didn't even realize you were a part of that. And there is so much dark side to comedy, but your head must be spinning because you work on the history of sitcom and that directly spills into the dark side of comedy, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
The history of sitcom, I remember, I DVR'd that, like I geeked out on that thing so hard.
Thank you. Thanks.
But how do you, this is like your approach to things. How do you encapsulate the history of sitcom in the world into an 8-episode
yeah.
series on CNN?
It's a lot of stuff on the floor. It's a lot
yeah.
of stuff you have to edit because you could sit, you know, I'm like you, I'm a geek, right? And you're sitting there with, I think one of my favorite interviews, anyways, I'll tell you after, but you're sitting with these people and you want to know so much, but you only can say, I'm interviewing
yeah.
you about Bob,
I know,
or I'm interviewing you about Good Times, but I want to know so much more and so many great moments are left on the floor. It's a shame.
But doing what you get to do, you get that pleasure button to hit for you, not for the audience, because you get to know all of these things. They're all in your head. Like, that's what I love about pop culture is it's an individual experience that we get to collect these amazing pieces of information. Yeah. And then hopefully we get to share them with strangers or start a conversation that gives you a secret language between you and other pop culture lovers. Let's get back to like how you started with all this, because I was reading this where you started doing celebrity caricatures at the age of seven, like Charlie Chaplin, Groucho Marx, you know, all of these things. And what really hit me, by the way, you guys, this gentleman has a Wikipedia page, for the love of God. This is when you know you made it, when somebody has a Wikipedia page.
Yeah, apparently that's if you made it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think you made it. So, but he, you know, they compared your style of caricature being greatly influenced by a gentleman named Al Hirschfeld. Mm-hmm. And Al Hirschfeld, if you guys don't know, he would do these caricatures in the New York Times. It would be Broadway stars, luminaries of stage and screen. And he would hide little things called Ninas. And I believe that was his daughter's name. And it would put like three or five. So you would be looking for the Ninas in these really complex caricatures. And my acting teacher in college, Marshall Mason, he made us read the New York Times every week to try to get us like into that frame of mind. And the caricatures, the Al Hirschfeld, it turned out to be my favorite part of the weekend of trying to find these Ninas. And you actually got to meet the man. Is that true?
Like, correct.
A little bit of a mentor situation.
Yes. You never know why you grasp onto pop culture or celebrities. You never know. At 7 years old, I don't know why, but I started to draw caricatures. And then when I turned, I think 14, my uncle bought me a book, and I've got, I don't know if you can see behind me, there's a few books stacked up there, and they're Hirschfeld books. They're about his artwork. And he bought me the top one. And when I saw that, I had never seen caricatures done that way. And I was hooked. And I started to emulate his way of drawing because I was just so amazed by what he did. And then I started to write to him as a teenager, maybe 18, 19 years old. And I started to share my caricatures with him. And eventually I was invited down to New York. I think I was 24, 25, got to meet him. I did a caricature of him for him. I got to see
his ballsy. That's really ballsy.
It is ballsy. Yeah. And but I was just, it was more out of love. It was out of love than balls, right? Well, the two are combined. But anyways, I was so honored to be able to correspond with him, send him my artwork that he could take a look at, eventually meet the man, see all of his original stuff in his studio hidden. Behind, I can't tell you. I have one of his pieces. I've got Audrey Hepburn in my living room, actually. And I've got, these books are signed from him. I've got a letter from him.
Oh, wow.
I was in New York last week and saw a play at the Al Hirschfeld Theater. And it's every time like that happens, I just get very, my heart just is so warmed by that. Yeah.
I read that name and it immediately just like it's wistful for a time that I you said, like just remembering the salad days, if you will. But then the other story that I was reading in this that I was blown away by, it was like 1987. You're on a flight from Toronto to Los Angeles, and legend Bea Arthur from Golden Girls, and she's on the flight, and you happen to show her, if this is true, a caricature of the Golden Girls. Is that correct?
100% true. Just a bit of a nugget for you. In Canada, we have a pharmacy chain called Shoppers Drug Mart. When Maude ended and she didn't have any shows going on, she got this long-term contract to be the spokesperson for this pharmacy, honest to God. And then the Golden Girls happened, but she was still locked in this pharmacy. So she's schlepping up to Toronto to do these commercials and going back to LA. And I was flying down to LA to shuck my wares, and I always carried my portfolio with a bunch of caricatures in it. And lo and behold, the Golden Girls caricature was in there. I go up to Bea and I say to her, I've got something I would love to show you. She goes, after we take off, come to my seat. I was in economy. She was in first class. I came to first class. There was an empty seat next to her. She had me sit down with her. We went through the whole portfolio. She loved the Golden Girls caricature. I ended up drawing a second one for the Whit Thomas Harris production offices that were hung there. And
she commissioned work from you at that point.
Yeah, and all four Golden Girls signed the caricature for me as well. Am I allowed to swear on this? I think I can swear on this podcast. You can totally. So the best part of that thing was, okay, the flight attendant wanted me to leave the seat. B. Arthur told me he's not leaving. I told her I'm not leaving. Anyways, we're going through my portfolio. And as we're going through every picture, caricature, there's one of Bette Davis. And B. Arthur goes, "This woman is a cunt." And that's even better than the Golden Girls story.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So apparently,
Bette Davis, everybody saw her next Tuesday. Yeah.
I love that. So, I mean, so you have this path that you're on and the caricatures, and you're meeting people through that.
Yeah.
But then how does it like pivot into production? How does it pivot into directing, producing, writing? You know, was that just a natural evolution from caricature?
No, it was, I was doing caricatures. I got very lucky, very young, and I was syndicated at age 20, and I was doing 35, 40 newspapers across Canada. And, then the recession hit and, lost a lot, if not all of that work. I was like, holy shit, what am I supposed to do now? You know, what do I do with this skill set of drawing celebrities? Nothing. So I ended up getting a job in advertising. Okay, whatever. 20 years later, I guess I'm like 40, 41. And, I say, I'm kind of like Peggy Lee. Is that all there is? I sort of did everything. I did everything I wanted to do. And the only thing I really ever wanted to do was to produce television. That's what I wanted. I was a kid who sat on the floor of a living room watching Hollywood Squares and Pyramid and saying, I want to be that. I want to do that.
Yeah.
And at 40, 41, I said to my wife, like, I want to change careers. And I kind of just took my advertising acumen, knocked on doors of broadcasters, tried to pitch shows, and I was just pitching titles. I didn't know anything about shows. And I got a job as a story producer, and I just applied. I said, listen, I don't know anything about TV, but I've been in advertising for 20 years. And within a year, I sold a show, and then I became an executive television producer, and that all happened and got nominated for a Canadian Emmy for that. And that was all within my first year. And it was like, well, this is kind of meant to be. Yeah.
How dare you? First off, can you manage my career? My God, this is what I'm talking about. How wild that you like just the love of that passion that drives you to do that. But at 40 or 41 years old, jumping into an entire new profession.
Yeah.
Like I had a teacher in the past that, you know, their motto was like, dare to suck, you know, just suck as bad as you can here. Yeah. So you can go out there in the real world. But you're like, you're not road tested. You're out there just doing it on the fly. But you have this history of your love of it. Did you find your love of it to be something in the end that completely gave you a leg up compared to other people in the industry that might just be doing it as a job and you came from love?
I'll tell you something, like not to get too deep. I'm very, the older I get, you know, the older we all get, the wiser we all get. And I look at what drives a person, and it's a passion, which is really your soul. And when you're a creative person and you find that niche in you that really, that's what you want to do, you will do whatever it takes to succeed because that's what you love. And a lot of people don't understand the creative industry, whether you're a painter, whether you're a musician, whether you're a television producer, is about enjoying your craft, knocking on as many doors as you can, and hopefully getting a couple breaks. You know, it's all about, years ago, this agent told me, this old time Hollywood agent said, you know, being creative, it's luck, timing, and talent. And in that order, and that success, the most talented people may not get the breaks, but the least talented people like me sometimes get the breaks. But it's really following your passion. And, you know, to change your career at 41, it's like, I decided that's what I'm doing and went after it. And it kind of all came together.
Was that a tough day for your wife?
Well, I didn't get sex that night, but look, I left a pretty decent job to say to her. And she said to me, you know what, Marshall, listen, you didn't know anything about advertising. You lost all of your syndication work and you succeeded in that. I have no doubt you'll succeed in this as well. And that was it. And it was really the first year was just living off a line of credit, doing what you can do. Yeah.
And then you see, actually, it can happen. Things are moving in this certain direction. But as a kid, and then, you know, even into your 40s, what were you drawn to in terms of pop culture? What were the things that made you buzz?
Oh, God. It's just the celebritydom. Is that even a word?
Sure, let's make it a word. Yeah.
I think, you know, the whole part of the caricature thing was this. How can a kid – where are you based, Ryan? Where are you?
Los Angeles.
Okay, you're in LA. So I'm in Toronto, okay? I came from a middle-class suburb of Toronto. I was a kid with no chance of ever saying, I'll meet Sherwood Schwartz or Norman Lear or Mel Brooks. But I love them. So I drew caricatures. That was my way to connect to them. And yeah. As I got older, I started to mail them the caricature and get their signature. Okay, now I've connected. I got their signature. They held this, right? And then it's like to meet the people that I sat on a floor in Toronto, never thinking in my entire life, never mind meet them. I'd work with them. I'd spend time with them. So it was the drive of just, I don't know, there's this love of celebrity.
Well, that's it exactly.
In my living room, you know?
I mean, I'm in Los Angeles now, but I grew up in a small Olathe, Kansas, and I would sit there watching.
There you go.
I would bet like Entertainment Tonight was appointment television to think that there was a place called Hollywood that was so far away from Kansas that I didn't think I could ever gain entry to. I didn't realize you could just go. I thought you had to be some kind of magical person to be able to. And that's why even in the down days, like I'll see that Hollywood sign and it'll still, or I'll drive down Sunset Boulevard and think about how many historical pieces of pop culture or celebritydom, like, you know, even like horrific things like, you know, River Phoenix died at the Viper Room, right? Right outside, you'll see this like history of Hollywood. And that's the stuff that like, you know, that kid in Kansas, you know, would be blown away that he, you know, like I am here right now. But not only celebrity, though, did you fall in love with the actual material that Hollywood was producing itself? Or was it more just celebrity driven?
Look, anything that was pop culture that I was a kid, you know, we had three channels years ago. Okay. And you watched everything in your living room with your family. It was a family event. And there was no reruns. Well, there were reruns. There was no VHS. There was no streaming. There was no whatever. If you missed a show, you were fucked. And so people like our generation, like you said earlier, pop culture is a language that's embedded in our heads, right? If I'm watching Welcome Back, Kotter, I'm absorbing so much of that shit because I don't know when I'm going to see that episode again. So then I would go out and buy the Welcome Back, Kotter, you know, bubblegum cards or the lunch boxes or the t-shirts. And because you don't know when you're going to see that shit again, right?
Yeah.
All of that 30-minute sitcom or whatever it may be was embedded in your psyche, embedded in your home, embedded in your lifestyle.
Yeah. And this is jumping ahead a little bit, but it's the question is, you know, I do long for those days of, you know, like the simplicity of having just a finite amount of stations. And now it keeps growing. We've now thrown social media onto it. TikTok is now kids' favorite station to watch in certain areas. Like, where are we headed? Like, the history of sitcom, you know, I was thinking about, like, you will not be able to potentially do a show like that 20 years from now because it would be impossible. And all our attention spans are in so many different directions. Like, does that make you sad in a way? Where do you see all this headed?
Yeah, I can't tell you, Ryan. It makes me so sad. And I'm in the industry. It makes me really sad. Nobody will ever, you know, the difference is now these TikTokers and whatever streamers, their fame skyrockets very quickly, but their longevity is much shorter. So they're in it for a minute, man. And whereas people like Jackie Gleason or Lucille Ball, they had 30, 40-year careers in our living rooms, okay? We knew these people. They were on magazine. You know, no one's going to have magazines anymore. But it is sad because, number one, we're disconnected as a society. We all watch our shit on our own. Nobody sits together as a family and watches series. I watch, even with my wife, she's watching her shit, I'm watching my shit. You know, but we do watch The Housewives together. That we do.
Hey, okay, good. Okay, we'll talk about that in a second.
That we do. But it's really sad because there will never be levels of stardom anymore. Like, I watch the Oscars and I'd be like, who the fuck are those people? Who's sitting in the front row? I don't even know this person. I don't know the artist. I don't know. I feel so disconnected. And it makes me very sad because I don't have the love as much as I had when I was a kid.
And also the mystery has disappeared in some ways of you would follow a celebrity and there was something about like you're doing almost like an archaeological dig on trying to find pieces of information. But now the pieces of information are so accessible that the mystery, like, you know, we didn't know what our favorite movie stars and TV stars were really doing, except that maybe, you know, you'd get a little blurb or a little like behind the scenes photograph from a paparazzi. But now it's everywhere. I was looking at the Oscars as well. And I have this conversation a lot with the audience about the last movie star, you know, and can we consider Timothée Chalamet to potentially be the great hope right now in terms of a actual Tom Cruise-ish kind of figure? Because right now, like you said, we don't know. I've given up almost on knowing everybody. I used to think that I could watch every film, every TV show, and I would be so proud every Sunday looking through the TV guide and crossing off what I had seen and what I hadn't.
You see? Do you do that, Ron? Do you do that? Do that all the time. You don't know, dude.
It was like, I was so proud. I used to get the Roger Ebert big book of like compendium of movies. And I would get it every year and then I would cry and I would circle the ones I wanted. And this is before you had access. Like I would have to go to the library or Blockbuster Video and try to get like Kurosawa films and things like that just to like keep up. And then you one day realize like, oh, well, a lot of these films are I don't know if I literally need to see Steven Seagal films. Like I get it already. You know, like I'm not going to see every one of those. But it gets me excited, but it also gets me sad because the thing that really drove me as a young adult into my adulthood is vanishing in some ways. But is there a positive spin that we can put on this and say, or you want to appreciate the love of like a youthful audience? You want to appreciate or try to see what they're seeing. But sometimes I just don't know. Like you said, like I don't see a breadth of a career with any of these people.
No, I think it's interesting you brought up Timothée Chalamet. I truly think that Tom Cruise is the last movie star. That's my opinion. When I saw the last Mission Impossible, the one with the train, I thought he's the last movie star. Timothée Chalamet, I think, is cannibalizing himself, to be honest with you. I think it's like, let's put Timothée Chalamet in everything. It's like, it's enough.
His head must be spinning. He's like, he's got so many offers right now.
And like, he's a good actor, but it's more about his look. I don't know. He has that impish. Anyways, I just feel it's too much of him already. It's like, to me, the greatest movie stars to me are starting to fade out. The Meryl Streeps, the,
I know. You know,
I like that Jodie Foster's coming back. I like seeing her again.
But by the way, coming back on serialized television.
Yeah.
You know, True Detective, which I thought I really enjoyed watching that. And has it been interesting for you to watch how like TV has turned into the new movies? Is that it's able to tell a longer story?
I don't like that.
You don't like that.
I like going to the theater. I like sitting in the dark. Like I remember years ago, you would see a horror film like When a Stranger Calls or something like that. And the whole audience would be jump at the same time, scream at the same time. And now you're sitting in your living room, you're putting a pause, you want to go get something to eat. Like it's not the same.
Well, and now when we do go to the theater, it's either usually for a Marvel movie. We're worried about coughing. We're worried, you know, if anything, that's why I think it's interesting. Like, Nicole Kidman should be doing AMC commercials. Whatever gets us talking about the theater experience.
Right.
Whatever gets us. I mean, put concerts in there. I don't care. I just don't want this to go away. I used to rant about this all the time of just the magic of the movies. And then you start to realize, you know, Christopher Nolan gave a speech on his Oscars. Like, we're only 100 years into this industry in terms of film. Where are we going to go? But part of that is there is change, but I don't want it. I don't want the theater going experience to disappear or only be made for films like Oppenheimer or Black Panther.
Yeah. You know what? We're cut from the same cloth, Ryan, when you said about the magic of the movies to me is missing. And I feel that watching Oscars, I'm still a kid. I like to watch Oscars. I sit there and I write down who I think is going to win still to this day. But I feel the Oscars are run by PR departments now. It's all public relations. Who's going to present? You know, years ago, they'd say, oh, here's coming up is Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, and Debbie Reynolds. And they'd all come out together to present something. It was movie history. They gave out an honorary Oscar to Mel Brooks, not at the Oscars, at a luncheon.
Isn't that wild?
they used to bring out these old people and everyone would applaud. And,
when Charlie Chaplin, I mean, this is before my time.
Right, when they let him come back. Right.
He received this special award after he had to leave Hollywood.
Yes, yeah.
And it was this really emotional moment that everybody stood up and he felt like he was loved again. And there's these stories. By the way, you guys, there's a book I read last year called Oscar Wars about the whole history of the Oscars that I highly recommend. But those are those moments. And they almost get shelved because it's not selling enough soap. You know, it's you're not getting the advertising dollars, or it's not sexy enough.
Right.
I think it is. That's why work that you're doing right now is so important. Dark Side of Comedy, History of Sitcom. So we can actually show people why these things deserve to be, have a second, a third look. We need to get younger audiences into the appreciation of a written joke in terms of the multicam sitcom, which is for most, like all intents and purposes, disappeared.
Yeah, yeah. You know what's really interesting? Not interesting. What actually pisses me off? It pisses me off the younger generation, and I feel like such an old fucking fart. The younger generation who gets into this business, they want to be a director, they want to be an editor, but they know sweet fuck all about how this industry started, or the greatest films of all time, or they don't know who Orson Welles is, or they don't know Chaplin. It's like, I'm sorry, you can't work in this industry if you haven't had the history.
Because then they watch a film and they don't realize that it's been cannibalized from something much earlier. Like, I remember, I'm trying to think which film it was, but I was like, well, yeah, All the President's Men is the one that actually literally did that for the first time and told this story about intrigue in Washington and all of this stuff. And you're like, but it's so funny because kids don't have that language to realize it's an homage. It's like building upon an art.
Are you talking about Spotlight?
I am, actually, yeah.
Yeah, that was the one. Right, exactly. It's All the President's Men with the newer cast.
Which is great. I love Michael Keaton. I love all of that stuff. But people don't realize this isn't like they didn't invent the wheel with Spotlight. This is a well-tread formula that is, you know, if you do it well, it sings. But I don't know. I find that really interesting. Now I'm thinking, though, I keep thinking about your cutting room floor comment. There needs to be a docuseries that you do just called Cutting Room Floor, and every little tidbit that left on the floor, and take us through the history of these little peculiar stories that you learned throughout. I mean, because I could talk to you for hours. Like, I mean, you're such a wealth of information. Before we get back to some more, well, we're going to get to a nerdy thing right here and get back to other
thing.
Nerdy stuff.
Okay, go ahead.
You
with
also
the nerdy.
Wrote
yeah.
that you have a huge pop culture memorabilia.
Oh my God. You don't even want to know.
Collection. Is that, is that true?
Yeah. You don't even want to know. Like,
what do you
have? As my wife calls it, junk that when you die, the kids don't want, you got to get rid of it. I have, like, even in my office, so my office that we're sitting in, every piece of furniture here is from the 60s. I don't know if you could, there's this great radio turntable there. A chair. I've got those little telephone tables over there. See over there?
Oh,
see the cool dial phone? Do you see the red, yellow, and black, or orange and black? I've got a cool TV from the 50s, right? You see what I've got happening?
Oh, my God.
So that's just furniture. Downstairs in my basement, I've got scripts from The Lucy Show. I don't know. A taxi. I don't even know. I've got toys from the I bought back all the toys from my childhood, all the board games I used to play with. I've got my Spirograph. I've got Battleship. I've got Big Jim and his camper. I can't even tell you the shit I got downstairs. And it's just, it's warm and fuzzy. It's warm and fuzzy shit that makes me feel good.
Yeah, that's what I was like. I mean, you answered it, but that was my next question is like, why do we do like, I chase down these things sometimes and then – if I go through, like I went through a divorce a long time ago and, you know, I realized when I was looking at this collection of stuff that I had, you know, that how like, oh, at the end of the day, it doesn't mean anything. And you almost had to work your way up to where these things mean something again, because you know that you can, you know, lose everything in a moment, if that makes sense. But, you know, it's like I used to track down, like we're from like a hair of a different generation, like the Knight Rider car that David Hasselhoff drew.
Yes.
I had that toy as a kid. And when I was able to get it on eBay, the amount of joy it brought me holding that in my hand and connecting it with a piece of childhood. And it is weird. Like I have so much of like just Batman paraphernalia that I was like, where do, I don't have a kid. Like, where does this legitimately
go? Is the Batman, the Adam West Batman?
I have all, like, I have the Adam West, the Michael Keaton, the, like, I collected Batman through the different iterations.
Okay, and so I was able to sit with George Barris in the actual
Batmobile creator.
I have a great photo of me and him in the actual Batmobile, which is cool. Adam, have you ever met Adam? Did you ever meet Adam?
No, my God, I would have freaked out.
You would have loved him. He was probably the greatest interview I ever had. He was the funniest man I ever met. And nicest,
guys, if you don't know,
kindest.
Adam West played the initial Batman in the TV series from the 60s. That was legendary at the time. It was like pop art dream. It was just incredible. I have the whole series on Blu-ray DVD if you ever want to borrow it, guys. That's it, though. Like, we're chasing this good feeling from our youth. Are there new things that give you that same feeling that you had as a kid, like new pieces of pop culture that give you that same, you know, button push?
No, which is, no? I could probably, I'm just saying, and I don't mean to be like an ass. I just don't get that thrill anymore. I have an appreciation for the art. I have an appreciation for the film. I don't walk out there like, I want to buy the t-shirt. I don't walk out, I want to buy the merchandise. It's a shame. I don't. I still love the craft, but I don't have that pop culture language with it anymore. Like, and I feel like even the only real pop culture I feel out there right now is the Marvel, right? Because there's the Marvel films, and truly, they're just a merchandising empire, is what they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's why they do those films. Because at the end of the day,
I just read this book on
Oscars.
Marvel. Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, the Marvel thing, and it's like blatant. Like, if they didn't, there's like this book about the history of Marvel, and it talked about, like, if they didn't sell enough toys, it almost like, we got to rearrange how we're doing these movies.
Movies, right. Exactly. So it's, that's sad. I think that's kind of sad, because the toy and the pop culture, all the items that come out of a TV show should be because the show was a success, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so when you started working in this industry, did a little bit more of the magic disappear because you actually saw how the sausage was made?
No, because working in the industry, I was just grateful. I was grateful in my 40s to be able to be part of something I wanted to do as a kid. And then as I've gotten older, there's certain times I have my pinch myself moments, you know, and like you, like, you know, even though I'm in Toronto, I do a lot of work in LA. I do a lot of work in New York. The LA, my days off from a shoot, I'll rent a car and I go to I'm an idiot. I go to this is where, this is the Cunningham house. And I go to, and I take pictures. I take selfies in front of, like, I go to cemeteries and I see where famous.
God. You've been to one in Westwood with Marilyn Monroe and Hugh Hefner next to each other and Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau.
Next to each other, Billy Wilder, they're all there.
Oh, it's wild. And by the way, you guys, it's in like the heart of Westwood. Like, you would never think this cemetery was there.
It's a weird entrance too. It's this tiny little entrance. Don Knotts is there.
Have you ever seen a movie at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery? They do the cemetery
but I've heard screenings. About those are supposed to be really cool.
That's wild too, because Alfred Hitchcock is buried there.
Yeah.
Joey Ramone, Chris Cornell. I mean, and it's so weird that they do these beautiful screenings of film during the summer, but it's kind of a little morbid, like just wondering if we're disturbing the peace of all these celebrities
part of me thinks they'd appreciate it. You know, my wife would laugh that I tell her I'm going to a cemetery, and then she came out to LA while I was filming and I said, we're going to a cemetery. And I schlepped her to the cemetery. She goes, actually, it's quite beautiful here to walk around. Yeah. I go, yes, it's amazing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Forest Lawn is another great cemetery as well, guys, if you're ever over in the Glendale area. Okay, so what are you like? We have Prison Sentences, which is a podcast. You guys, it's like so bite-sized. You're going to love it. It's really quick, funny. I mean, what even gave you the idea of writing to prisoners to try to be prison pen pals?
Okay, so I thought of a book, because I've written to celebrities for so many years and had them sign caricatures of me. I don't know where I saw the term prison sentences, but I just saw it and my creative mind said, prison and sentences, writing letters. So I said, what if I write letters to these criminals and make a book? And my son, my second oldest, said, Dad, why don't you do a podcast? You're funny. Why don't you make this into a comedy? And I said, do you think it's proper to do comedy and crime? Like, it's kind of like sacrilege, right? And he said, no, just write them stupid letters. So I write the stupidest letters I could think of. I never mentioned the crime. never talk about the crime. And, you know, there's like, okay, BTK, who wrote me, you know, BTK, Bound, Torture, Kill.
Yeah, right? I know.
I wrote him, and I write them letters like, oh, I found out BTK worked for the Coleman company that makes camping equipment. So I wrote him a letter. I'm like, hi, BTK. What did you do at Coleman? And what kind of camping equipment? And did you ever like to go camping? And he wrote me this whole letter back about camping.
So the BTK killer wrote you a whole letter back about camping equipment?
Yeah, he liked to go camping with his family and tell scary stories. And he made like coolers. And I'm like, oh, okay. But it's like, it's kind of, it's so morbidly funny and cool that you gotta, you know, the podcast, I read the letter I wrote to them. And then the letter
well,
they
wrote
back.
Give a history. You give a history of the person. Like you gave a history of Betty Broderick.
Yeah,
of,
very
you know, her
short,
crimes.
Yeah.
Very short. Like this is like, I'm talking 5 minutes. I was like, there's no way you can get this in 5 minutes. Yeah. But you know, also you wrote to Betty Broderick about Tupperware
I wrote to Betty Broderick. She sold Tupperware to fund the husband's legal career that she killed. I wrote to Pamela Smart. I wrote to John Gotti years ago. Charles Manson, I wrote to him. I did a caricature of Charles Manson and John Gotti. I wanted to know what they thought of it. So I sent it to them and they wrote me back.
Well, yeah, we can talk about that on this show as well. It's like pop culture is not just TV and film anymore.
Right.
It's true crime.
True crime is definitely
pop culture, which I think is so weird and interesting. And sometimes you're so desensitized where it has entered this pop culture language. And so it is that weird, like you were talking about earlier, of like treating it respectfully or can we pull humor from something this dark?
Yeah. I you know, the biggest thing I had with my boys, as I said to them, they said to me, actually, do not make fun of the victim. In the podcast.
Oh, God, no, yeah.
Do not make a joke about the victim. You can make a joke about the criminal because they're pieces of shit, a lot of them. But don't make fun and make fun of maybe just the whole concept of what went on here. So there is this dad humor in it. But yeah, like, for example, you said about pop culture, Gypsy Blanchard, you know.
I mean, huge, right? She all of a sudden
huge
exploded
in pop culture.
On it. She's getting up to Kardashian levels on Instagram all of a sudden. And I thought, how wild that we have now made her internet famous. You know, she participated in a very grisly, dark crime.
Okay, Gypsy Blanchard, people are buying t-shirts, mugs, memorabilia about her. It's like she's no Lucille Ball, but yeah.
She's a star. People are wondering what she's going to do next.
Yeah. I'll tell you what she's going to do next. She'll kill somebody next.
What are you going to do next? Like, what's the next big project that you're working on right now or something that you have in your mind of, I want to tell this story?
Right now, I am... Well, when is this? Is this going to air in the next 2 days?
It's
going to
air in like 2 weeks.
Okay, 2 weeks. That's fine. I just got... There's a show I'm working on for A&E. It's a very... easy, nice show about lakefront properties. Just got renewed for 40 episodes, which I was really happy about. So it gets a good audience on A&E. So I'm going to be producing and directing that, which is a nice contract. Prison Sentences is 20 episodes a season. I've gotten now 75 letters back. So that's 3.5 years of podcasts on that one.
Wow.
And what else? I don't know. You know, when you're creative, there's always things you want to do. I know I want to do a book of my celebrity caricatures and the ones that have been signed and the stories behind them, like the B. Arthur story or, you know, the Lucille Ball story when I pretended to be a flower delivery guy and went to her house. That type of shit. Yeah.
Wow, you really put yourself out there. I mean, imagine if you had TikTok when you were a kid doing this. You would have filmed these encounters. It would have
been
well documented.
Totally.
Who is the meanest celebrity to you?
Oh, you want to know?
When you were growing up.
The meanest celebrity I was in person, you mean? Just in my career?
Yeah,
or what
do
you mean?
To you. Like who was the meanest celebrity to you personally?
Personally, Larry David.
Really?
Not even.
Why? What happened?
Not even. I didn't have to think about that one.
What was the story?
He's just an asshole. Larry David is Larry David.
Was this during history of the sitcom?
No, I interviewed him about 12, 13 years ago for another show. It was on camera. I was on camera with him. And he just was like, just a bit of a prick. And it's like, dude, you got so much money. Be nice. Be kind. You don't have to complain. He just is just him. He's just a prick. And he makes you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He makes you feel uncomfortable because he's so uncomfortable to be around.
Well, that's interesting too, like the history of the sitcom, how it's like, it used to be like hard punchlines and then it like kind of shifted even with The Office, is the joke is the uncomfortableness. The joke is what is said in between the lines of the uncomfortable thing that Steve Carell said, the mean thing that Larry David said. It then turned from hard punchlines to reaction shots.
Right, exactly. Like, you look at comedy writing has been in threes, right? You do the 1-2-3 punch, right? It's the 1-2, the punch is the third.
The beat,
and then we
have
Arrested Development or Parks and Recreation, like I said, in The Office. This is about mainly one or two characters that are odd. And they don't know that they're odd.
Yeah.
And the things that they're saying are perceived differently. You know, you had a bit of that in Taxi.
Well, I mean, yeah, because you had a lot. You had the Danny DeVito, Andy Kaufman's character, Christopher Lloyd's
character. And Judd Hirsch was the moral compass, right?
Yeah,
and
I always call him the reliable narrator. The reliable narrator that we relate to.
The humor, they didn't know they were being funny or odd, the rest of the people. He knew.
Yeah. Yeah. I revisited Taxi a while back, and it's just still so good. Taxi holds up.
It does. Okay, can I just share a crazy story?
Please.
My family lived in Los Angeles for about 2 years in the 70s, and I lived in the Valley. My dad was trying to open up some businesses and blah, blah, blah. And I went to school, and I met this kid, and his name was Alex, and his last name was Hirsch. And this is 78. It ended up being Judd Hirsch's son. I didn't know who Judd Hirsch was because Taxi hadn't been a show yet.
Yeah.
And I was over at Alex's house and, you know, with his dad, and we'd go swimming and all of this shit. Anyways, he says, my dad just got a show, a TV show. Would you like to come to the filming of it one day? Sure. So it was, the show had been greenlit. They did the pilot of Taxi. The show was greenlit. This was episode 7, I believe. So it hadn't aired yet. Taxi hadn't aired. Before cell phones and all this shit, I go to my mom, my parents, I go, I'm going to go to the set with Alex to see his dad. Okay. This limo picks us up at 6 a.m. We go to Paramount Studios. It was Friday. It was the day of a taping. I meet people. Alex is introducing me to people. I meet, this is my dad's boss. And it was Danny DeVito. I thought it was actually his boss. So I meet Danny DeVito and Jeff Conaway and Tony Danza and all. And I was playing around on the set of Taxi, blah, 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 go to the taping. Then we go into the after party. And I'm a kid. Like, I'm like 12, right? 12, 13. We go to this after party. So I'm, this is the best story. And it was years, you know, years later, you think, go, holy shit, I didn't realize that. We go to this filming of this episode. I go into Judd Hirsch's car. Alex is in the front seat. Judd's in this driving. I'm in the middle, and to my right is this actress named Arlene Galanka, who is the guest star. And to my left is Andy Kaufman, who played Latka on the show. And we're driving to the after party. And I never really, and then I got home 3 a.m. My mom's like, where the fuck have you been? Anyways, Judd drops me off at home. And to this day, I have a great autograph that Judd says, we had the best day today, didn't we? And he dated everybody. But it was only years later that I said, I was in the backseat of the car with Andy Kaufman at age 13. Yeah.
Yeah. God. I mean,
yeah.
and did you, what was the set? I mean, as a 13-year-old, do you even get a sense of who that, like, not of what he's about, but did you feel like, oh, I'm sitting next to a weird guy right now? Like, do you even get a sense as a kid?
No, I was honestly, I didn't. I was more thrilled that day that I got to go visit the Little House on the Prairie set on Paramount and met Michael Landon and Jack Albert.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So and that day, this is also really cool. So that day, I went to see Laverne and Shirley rehearse. Because we were running around like kids on a set,
holy,
right?
Holy, Laverne and Shirley rehearsing?
Yeah, so I was in the bleachers watching Laverne and Shirley, and who's sitting next to me in the bleachers watching them rehearse was Robin Williams, because he had just been cast as Mork on Happy Days.
Yes!
He hadn't yet
Happy
gotten
Days
Mork and Mindy.
Led to Mork and Mindy,
right,
yes.
But he hadn't been cast yet at Mork and Mindy. He was Mork on Happy Days. That's how I knew him. So I got his autograph while he was sitting next to me, but that was that day. Yeah,
do you still
cool
have that
day.
Autograph?
Of course I do.
That's amazing.
I keep everything, Ryan. I keep everything.
Oh, yeah. But the Andy Kaufman of it all, I had an Andy Kaufman fascination like right before Man on the Moon came out. And you guys, there's a brilliant documentary, a really weird documentary on Netflix called Andy and Me about Jim Carrey portraying the role of Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And he went fully method. Like Judd Hirsch, Danny DeVito, they all like played parts in the actual movie Man on the Moon. But it is... I really like the Bob Zamuda of it all. I fell in love with the history of Andy Kaufman, of just somebody like being performance art level comedy before we even knew what performance art was, and putting that onto a national show like Taxi. I mean, just having to work with somebody like that, that was so committed to the bit. Yes. It's another just fabulous story about Hollywood. And Marshall, you have all of them. This has gone way too fast. I hope you enjoyed your time with me. And by the way, if you ever come to Hollywood, I would love to take you to lunch.
Oh my God. I was about to say, if I come down to LA again, we're going to get in a car and we're going to drive around. Oh. There's places. I'll show you shit. Like, it's just, I have the best time.
I needed this conversation today. I've been in Housewives land, Real Housewives and all this stuff.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's sometimes you've long for the days of just watching, you know, just studying pop culture generally and not reality stars. And I had a feeling I was going to love this, but I didn't realize how much I would love this. So thank you so much for coming today. But
Ryan,
how do we support you? How do we support you and what you do? Because you do everything.
I would love people to listen to the podcast. That's my new little project. It's just prison sentences. That's it by me. Just, they're 5 minutes an episode. You can sit, go for a walk for an hour and listen to 12 apps. Like, it's,
yeah.
That's my own little personal project. I'd like to see where it goes, because I think I'll do a book after that. And how do you support me? Just go learn about television and go learn about movies and go learn about the history. What's film noir and how did the sitcom come to be? And what did Desi Arnaz contribute to the industry? And do all that shit. And if you ever go to LA, don't go see the new shit. Go on a tour that shows you how it all started. That's what you can do for me. That would be something.
And by the way, start off with like History of Sitcom, which is, I believe, streaming on Max right now, if I'm not mistaken, all 8 episodes.
Yeah.
It really is a love letter to these things that I just grew up loving so much. But if you want to study history, I would say start there and work your way down, because usually what happens when you watch these things, it sends you down a rabbit hole. And we have so much information at our fingertips that you're going to find yourself in some really interesting little territories that's going to give a breath of fresh air to something in a world right now that seems potentially so dark, when there are so many great things out there that we can consume to battle the negativity that is out there right now.
Yeah.
But Marshall J. Kaplan, I hope to talk to you again. Honestly, this was just so great for me. I really appreciate your time today.
Likewise, Ryan, it really was, like you said, it was a breath of fresh air. You know, the world is a dark place, and pop culture and all of this stuff we love is our comfort food to our souls. So it's really been awesome to talk to you, and no bullshit. If I'm in LA, I'm going to stalk you. We're going to go out somewhere. We're going to hang, and that'll be it.
Would love it. We'll talk to you next time.
All right, buddy. Cheers.
So Bad It's Good is a Betches Media production. The show is hosted and produced by me, Ryan Bailey, with Meditza Lopez and Sandra Fryer. Additional support provided by Sean Kilby, Jorge Morales-Pico, and Rebecca Steinberg. Guest booking by Ali Friedlander. Video promotion by Laura Valencia. Be sure to send us your emails at sobaditsgoodwithryanbailey@gmail.com and follow the show at sobaditsgoodwithryanbailey on Instagram. And for additional craziness, go to patreon.com/sobaditsgood. Stay bad, baddies. Thank you to our sponsor, Hulu. Their new reality series, Vanderpump Villa, is an unfiltered portrait of what it is like to work in the glamorous French countryside while striving to impress Lisa Vanderpump. As guests arrive for their lavish vacation, the Vanderpump Villa staff are pushed to their limits, ready to cater to every whim, all the while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. Betches.